Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I wrote an article at Motherly a few years ago that has, over the years, become one of our more popular pieces. And the title of it is, Mom Rage is a Symptom of a Much Deeper Problem. Mom rage is a symptom of how much we expect from mothers and how little society supports them in that work. And the piece goes on to talk about how I overreacted to my husband when he said something about the dishes in the sink. And I admit that I overreacted, but in that moment I realized, you know, I'm not overreacting alone to one comment from my husband. I, that day, felt so burnt out on so many levels, and my frustration came out in that way. Mom rage is a deep problem in society. It is something that we don't talk about a lot, but many of us know what we mean when we allude to mom rage. We've all been there in feeling overwhelmed and unsupported and being so frustrated that it comes out in rage. And it's time to recognize that this rage comes from a place so many times of not getting the support that we actually need to thrive as moms. So there is a reason to this rage, but it doesn't mean that we need to stay this way. And I think today's conversation is an opportunity to figure out how to turn that anger as a catalyzing force for change in what we can control individually and what we can call for as a greater society. Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy. I'm a co-founder of Motherly, and I'm also a mom of five myself. Today's guest is Minna Dubin. Minna is a writer about motherhood and identity. I really wanted to have her on this podcast to talk about her new book, Mom Rage, The Everyday Crisis of Modern Motherhood. We cover a lot of ground in this episode, including the unique psychological experience of mom rage, the guilt and shame that follows it, and Minna's personal journey to understanding her own rage. Most importantly, we dive into all the ways that modern society and unrealistic maternal expectations really set us up for these cycles of anger and what we can do on an individual and social level to mitigate it, because we want to see a world in which all mothers get to thrive. Minna Dubin, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here and talk to you.
So I like to start most of my conversations with this question, because I think it tells us a lot about your journey. What surprised you about motherhood?
I think both the sweetness, just like how unbelievably sweet these like little beings are, even as they grow. Like when I still get these moments with my oldest, you know, he's only 10, so he's still really soft, you know, and I have like his soft little cheek against mine, and I'm just like, oh, it's so good. So I think the sweetness, and then also just how all-encompassing surround sound it is. It never really stops. Like even when they're at school or something, like I'm always dealing with mom stuff. I don't think I realized how 24/7 a gig it was. Like even when they're not here, I'm in mom brain.
I think I said that to my husband last night. Like the hard thing is that you're a mom 24/7. You're certainly a dad 24/7 too, but as you talk about in your work, moms are the ones who are typically on 24/7, 365. Over the years, how have you learned personally to cope with that always-onness of motherhood?
Well, school really helped. Having both my kids in school and after school and just getting this large swath of time has really helped. And some of it has honestly been stepping away a little bit from some of the responsibilities and letting my husband take on more. He definitely does more and I do somewhat less than I used to. This year, I don't know how it happened. I don't know if I put him as parent guardian number one on the school's paperwork or if he put himself and didn't put me. But for some reason, I'm not getting any of the emails from either of their teachers this year. And I'm both a little bit freaked out and also, let it be, Minna. Don't say anything. Just let him handle it, you know?
And I know it's been a journey to get there. So let's talk professionally. You, of course, were a writer for many years before becoming a mom. But as a journalist, I guess I'm wondering how writing about motherhood shaped your own understanding of what you were going through in this period of matrescence. How do you look back on that period of your career and your motherhood journey?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I actually stopped writing for the first 2 years of motherhood completely. I just found motherhood to be totally all-encompassing and I could not imagine doing anything else. It just took every ounce of my energy. And then when I started writing, I started doing this list project called Mom Lists. Because all I was doing as a mother was writing lists, like to-do lists and birthday party lists and thank you cards lists and all that. And so I started writing these lists about motherhood, about my experience, and I was posting them online. And they were pretty vulnerable and it was pretty scary to put that stuff out there, even as a memoir writer who's used to writing private stuff and putting it in the world. The internet is a scary place and I didn't know how people would react to it, but I got such positive feedback from moms that I was like, oh, this is not just me struggling. And so I think that was my first taste of processing my motherhood experiences in a more public way through my writing. And it was very positive. And so it sort of encouraged me to keep doing it.
So that was the beginning. And then there was the pinnacle in many ways. You went viral for a piece you wrote in the New York Times about mom rage. And I was surprised to see that it was actually published when I looked back before the pandemic, right? Because there was this peak rage moment during the pandemic when mothers didn't feel heard, but you were already personally experiencing that and then witnessing it in the culture in 2019, in the before times. So tell us about writing that piece and what you think it tapped into within the broader culture of motherhood and just what's happening in America today.
I think that that piece, The Rage Mothers Don't Talk About, which was published originally in September 2019, tapped into this hidden emotional crisis. I think there is a maternal mental health crisis of rage that is definitely American and also international because I talked to moms around the world really for this book that I wrote, Mom Rage. And to me, mom rage is not a pandemic specific experience. But I think what the pandemic did for moms is because we were all stuck in our homes and everyone was on the internet, and there was no other place to be except your home, I think that we all started talking about the home in this way that we weren't necessarily talking about it so publicly. And it was such an unforeseen circumstance that the game felt changed in this way where we were allowed to say it. But I think that mom rage was happening long before the pandemic. I think it will happen long after that. I just think that the pandemic was sort of like a bomb that anyone who wasn't already feeling mom rage was feeling it. And anyone who was already feeling it but wasn't talking about it was talking about it.
So let's talk about mom rage, such a powerful term, so relatable. Certainly when we've covered it at Motherly, those pieces go viral. Moms search for these topics. And thankfully, people like you are being vulnerable in order to raise awareness around this. So I'm curious how you define mom rage. And talk about your framework of what's underneath this experience of rage.
I describe mom rage as the uncontrollable anger that mothers feel during pregnancy, postpartum, and beyond. And I think about it as an international emotional crisis that is affecting mothers. And there's two levels of it, right? Like on the surface, it can appear as a mother having an anger problem. A kid stands there staring at their clothes, not getting dressed every single morning. And you're just like, get dressed, get dressed, get dressed. And the like 100th time, the bus is going to be there in 20 minutes. You have a brief due at work. Then you're like, get dressed. So from the outside, it looks like the mom can't control herself. But what's actually happening and is the deep roots of mom rage is the lack of systemic support from the society and also from within the family system, combined with the unbelievable and impossible expectations of modern motherhood. This period that we're in is called intensive motherhood, where we're constantly mothering all the time. And our job is to kind of be always bettering our children, getting them into the best schools, doing the extracurriculars, doing like toddler soccer on Saturdays and violin on Sundays. It's a lot for moms. And so there are these uncontrolled explosions, basically, that come from so much overwhelm and stress and all the support that mothers aren't getting. It's in the home and it's systemic. So it includes that we don't have family leave in America, that it can be very difficult to access mental health help for mothers, that the postpartum period is supposedly over after like 6 weeks in the way that our medical system looks at it. The gender wage gap, and then your wages go down when you become a mother, called the motherhood penalty. Like, it's just all these things. There's so much. It's like this tornado of the ways that really the society neglects mothers, and mom rage is the reaction of it.
Tell us the story of your own mom rage and how you coped with it and processed it, both with your children and also in the work that you've done in trying to uncover what it is underneath this feeling of outrage.
I tell this story in the book. One of my really early experiences of mom rage that really scared me initially, I was with my son and he was maybe 3 or 4, and we were crossing the street walking home from preschool. And it was one of those big Berkeley streets where there's no stoplights or stop signs. It's just a crosswalk. And the cars in Berkeley, unlike the East Coast where I'm from, just actually stop for you. And we were midway across the street to the median. And my son just kind of went boneless. And so I had to hold his hand and kind of lift his entire body from his hand. And he's sort of playing. And I'm like, stop. You have to get out of the street. We have to keep going. And someone from the car kind of yells out, like, make his ass get up. So everyone is in their cars idling, watching this scene happen. And I end up reaching over, picking up my son, going to the median. The cars pass by and we go back to the place we started. We cross back over and I'm like, we're going to try this again. This is not okay. You cannot do that in the street. It's super dangerous. And he's like, no, I'm not doing it again. And I'm like, well, you're going to sit here until you're ready. And I like push down on his shoulders for him to sit and his butt hits the ground and then he's unsteady and he falls back and his head hits the pavement. And this woman walks by and like gives me a dirty look, you know, and I pick him up and I'm rocking him and I'm like, oh my God, are you okay? And he starts to cry and he's all right. I check his head. Everything's fine. We cross back across the street. Everything is fine. But that moment of, was I so upset? Was I so frustrated that maybe I wasn't my most careful self with his body? Really, really scared me. That I had been so freaked out with fear that his bodily impulses were going to get him hurt, that I had been out of control. And that was my first moment with mom rage where I was like, oh, this is scary. I just scared myself.
You also talk in the book, you say, motherhood reveals all the aspects of ourselves that we need to work on. And that is true. And so is that we are mothering in a society that puts all the pressure on us and none of the support. And not just politically, with the lack of paid leave, the lack of affordable childcare, on and on and on, but also culturally. We largely raise kids in nuclear families without the village, which for all of human history until 300 years ago is how we raised kids. So when did you realize that you both needed to work on these things that were coming out within your mom rage? And so much of it was stemming from the unfair and unjust structures around you.
Realizing that I needed to do something about it came much earlier than realizing that it was bigger than me just being a terrible mom. I did not realize that there was a social overlay to what was going on for me until I wrote that article for the New York Times and I started getting emails back from other mothers. I got hundreds of emails, and then I was like, oh, this is not just me. I can't imagine that all these mothers are terrible mothers. something bigger is happening here. And so then I started interviewing and researching and studying motherhood and looking at scientific research papers and all of that, and realized that there was so much more going on. Even in that moment, like the one with my son, there were all the people watching, all the people judging mothers, which our world loves to do. And then there was also all the stuff happening at preschool. My son at that point was undiagnosed with sensory processing disorder and autism spectrum disorder. And every day I would pick him up and the teacher would give me the hit report of what kid he had harmed in some way. And I had to manage the like appropriate social response, both to the teacher and then do I need to talk to the parent? I was under all of this pressure and stress from school. And that had been maybe 5 minutes before we walked home. And part of that is society's lack of support for families who have kids who are not neurotypical or have disabilities. So it stems back to society, but when you're in like the tiny little bubble of motherhood, it is so hard to see beyond, I just yelled at my loved one and I feel terrible.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Give us a picture for those who may be realizing through this conversation that the mom rage they're experiencing, it's not just them and it's not their own personal deficiency. It is part of a much broader system that conspires against mothers. Can you paint us a picture of these levels of society that are failing to support mothers and families and children?
Sure. I mean, we talked about the lack of family leave. And the U.S. is one of 6 countries that doesn't offer paid family leave. The other 5 are like tiny countries that you've probably never heard of. We have the worst maternal death rate of all industrialized nations that has been rising since 1987. And it is 3 times worse if you are a Black woman or an Indigenous woman. When we think about schools also, everything is set up in our culture for there to be a 2-parent family, for one parent to work and one parent to be the caregiver of the children. School ends at 2:30 or 3, but the workday doesn't end till 5 or 6. And so who is in charge of those 3 hours? It is almost always the mother in different sex partnerships. And even in same-sex partnerships, what I discovered is that it is very common for one partner to be the working partner and one partner to be more of the caretaker partner, because everything in society is set up for it to be like that. And so most of the pressure is on one partner, and it's usually the mother. Even if there's after school, it's the mother who's setting up the after school, making sure the payment goes in every month, all of that. I talk about the PTA. Because of the disinvestment in schools, mothers end up having to do all of this unpaid labor to make the schools run, to get donations. And every little thing that the mother does in the home, whether it's folding the laundry, getting the kid to school, doing pickups and drop-offs, communicating with the teachers, all of that is a little gift to the father because it's a gift of time. So fathers get to show up to work early, stay there late. They get to have their minds free, right? They're not like, oh, I got to go take my kid to the doctor's office this afternoon. I got to leave early at 2, right? Moms tend to have more flexible jobs because of it. So the whole system is set up that way for moms to have most of the pressure on them.
I want to just pause there for a second, because you do mention in the book a bit of a historical perspective that I found interesting. And the idea that it was actually the Industrial Revolution that began really separating work from the home, sending men out to do work that over time we all we're told, was more important than the labor that was taking place inside the home. And then, ironically now, many of us working back in the home, working from home, and now this division of labor is kind of up for grabs again. I guess my point is, it hasn't always been like this. And so can you help give a bit of a historical perspective on how we value women and work and caregiving, and how that's different than historically we've thought about both the role of women and mothers, and then whose job it is to raise children?
I think the headline for this is that motherhood, as we know it today, is a socially constructed identity and experience. Even though birthing babies and caring for children is like a beautiful and singular experience, but we have an institution of motherhood, which is how the society sets us up to experience it. The idea that the mother is the primary caregiver, or that mothers are biologically set up to be the caregiver, is a new idea in the last couple hundred years with the Industrial Revolution. Originally, the focus was more on fathers. In the 1800s, actually, parenting books were written to fathers or to parents in general, but not to mothers. It wasn't assumed that the mother was the reader. It was assumed that the father was the reader. The home and work was one entity when there was farms. Everyone was doing all of the work. The kids were laborers. They were part of the family work. But around the turn of the 1900s, kids started to be seen as precious. And this idea of childhood is like this special time. And the idea of kindergarten, kids should have a play-based year because this is special and they're special, right? Playgrounds didn't exist before then. There should be a special place, not just alleyways and sand piles. And so as the ideas of childhood started to change, if these were precious beings, then whoever was going to take care of them, that role started to take on this golden special sheen. And so as children became precious, mothers became precious. And it was this idea that motherhood and mothering is like this very mythical, almost beautiful thing. And so with the Industrial Revolution, when fathers went to factories, mothers were in the home. And so the home took on this place of coziness and raising children. Like, all of this stuff about the home and about mothers really started then. And it has just grown over time. And with World War II, there was a moment where it changed. The men went to war and they needed all the mothers to work in factories. And so they made federally funded childcare centers, 6 days a week of childcare, including holidays. And they gave them meals for these moms to work in the factories. But when the men came home, they had to do a shine campaign to get mothers to go back in the homes, to make mothers believe that their place was actually in the home. And that if they were working, they were bad mothers. So it's the cultural messaging that we get. And a lot of those ideas from the 50s still exist today.
I just think it's so important to put the moment that we're experiencing, as you have, into this broader context, because we can all take for granted that it's my fault. I forgot it was dress down day at school and I need to be a better mother. And I didn't go to my son's baseball game this weekend because I was doing this other thing back at the house. And somehow I'm not mom enough when this idea that children's lives are so precious that I should be consumed by motherhood. And that is a historic idea that we're living through right now. And that also we're mothering without structures that we've always had. And I think it's just easy, maybe because our moms didn't have them either, but it's easy to say, oh, well, that's just how it is. But no, it hasn't always been this way. In fact, this is the abnormal part of human history.
That's right. That's right. And that pressure is singular to mothers. I remember last year, I forgot to fill out the forms for my kids to get their pictures taken on picture day. And my daughter, who was in kindergarten, so it was her first school picture day, she got there and they wouldn't take her picture because she didn't have the forms filled out. She came home and she was so upset. And of course, I felt guilty forever that I had messed up and had not filled out the forms for picture day. But my husband also didn't fill out the forms for picture day. I don't think he sat there feeling guilty about it. And that's the difference of the pressure, the way that we view motherhood and fatherhood.
Yeah. And there's an extent to which I need to learn from that not caring. And there's also an extent to which society doesn't expect that of him. So he's not a lacking father when he's not filling out the picture day form. Whereas I feel like on some level, I am judged. Why is this mother not have it together?
We have so swallowed the messaging that even if you're not being judged by the outside, it doesn't matter because you will certainly judge yourself.
So I do want to talk about this mom rage cycle that you've mentioned in the book, because as we both know, we can't stay in rage. We can stay angry, but rage is not something I want to live with in my body. So what are the ways that we get trapped in a repeating cycle? And then what are the ways that we can survive and even think about what it takes to thrive as a mom in the midst of all of these pressures?
Okay, let me tackle that one at a time. So it's a physiological system that happens with mom rage where before you explode, so many things have happened. Like you don't realize that you are ramping up towards an explosion long before that happens to you. So some of that is just like the daily irritations. Some of that is the ways that women learn to tamp down our anger instead of processing it or expressing it in healthier, calmer ways. And so by the time we explode, we have been working so hard for days, possibly weeks, to not explode. And what we forget is that before we scream about like, get dressed, right? There was the 20 times before where we used our perfect mother voices and we said, please put your clothes on. Here, I'll open the drawer for you. How about these three? We forget all the ways that we did a great job parenting. And then once you do rage, your nervous system stays in a state of excitation for days. And so you're more likely actually to rage again once you have raged.
And can I just add to that? What I've also noticed is, guess what happens after I yell at my kids? They start yelling at each other. They might listen to me because she raised her voice, but I'm then teaching them how to scream when they're angry. And I literally have watched it almost like a contagion ripple across the family. And not to blame moms, but just to acknowledge that these feelings are socially contagious in my experience within the family too.
For sure. Well, one of the things that happens with mom rage is right afterwards, we go through a shame spiral where we feel guilty. We feel terrible that we just yelled or stomped or whatever at the people that we love so much. And those feelings of regret and guilt and shame are really immense. And they can stop us from actually doing the work that needs to be done. So one of the things that I focus on in the book is, instead of pushing our shame as far away from us as possible, actually flipping that and giving both ourselves and our rage, because those are the same, right? Your rage is part of you, to look at it with compassion. Instead of being like, go away, I don't want anything to do with you, you're the worst thing in the world, rage, to actually say, okay, it's okay, come here, you know, just like you would a kid or like a cat.
Yes, I love the phrase you used saying you invite your rage to tea, which gives like a safe space and also a detachment from the rage. It gives you a way to process that, to ask yourself questions around that. I love that as a tool, so to speak.
Right, because our rage actually contains a ton of information that can be really useful to us. So if we become sociologists and really start asking questions of our rage and start examining it, like, okay, this is a problem. Let's research it. Let's understand it. Even though we're never going to stop being mad if the societal architecture that is neglecting mothers worldwide doesn't change, we still have control over the way that we express our fury and who we express it to and how. And so asking questions about our rage, like looking at locations, where am I raging? Is it always in the kitchen? Is it always in the house? Are there other people there? When other people are there, do I stop myself because I'm embarrassed of my rage? Is it always after we go to visit this one person? What's happening with the rage? Like, what was the situation? And if we actually start to track it, we will learn about ourselves and about what triggers us and basically get smarter about it so that we can then have more awareness. Like, I'm not crazy about the term mindfulness, but it really is a mindfulness because we'll be like, oh, I can feel it. Like, I'm getting hot right now. I feel like you're being disrespectful. And I know that feeling disrespected is one of the things that makes me lose my mind. And so I'm going to take a break. let's come back in 5 minutes. And my kids are older now, so I can actually say that, or they can say it. Sometimes my older one will be like, let's take a break.
Oh, I love that. My daughter too.
Yeah. And I talked to moms who had moms themselves who raged. And there was a big difference between the ones who had mothers who never acknowledged the rage and never talked about it with their kids and never apologized for it, versus the mothers who would talk about it and hug their kids and apologize and also be physically loving with hugs. Like, the difference was very stark in how those now grown up mothers feel about their mothers. And so I would say that the repair process is also a hugely important part of managing your rage.
What about our partners, specifically the male partners that we have that may not experience all the cultural norms of modern intensive motherhood? Obviously, we probably married them or partnered with them for a reason, right? We like them, we shared a vision. But as parenthood can bring up the past and the present in ways that are kind of unforeseen for couples. So I guess, how did you navigate getting on the same page with your husband? And what advice do you have for moms who are listening and are like, you know what the source of my rage is? Him.
Yes. I think that just as many moms are triggered by their husbands as they are by their children. And I think that rage tries to drive a wedge between people. I know that it certainly has between my husband and me, and that if I yell at him, he does not want to be anywhere near me, right? It does not bring us together. And I definitely would push him away as well, because I would be in the shame spiral and feeling terrible about myself. And I would not accept any kindness from him anyway, because I was a terrible person. So one of the things that's been really important for me is to push past the shame and to try to talk to him about it. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that our partners are actually the next best experts on our rage after us, and that they actually have information for us as well. If we can bring them in as allies and ask for their help, they can be really useful for us. They notice when we're about to lose it if we ask them to observe us, because we have physical tells, whether it's like deep breathing or our voice drops an octave or our hands start getting involved as we talk, as we're getting angrier. And they can actually tell us. Sometimes different moms have a code word that they would use, or a code phrase, which is basically a way to say, are you about to lose it? And that can be really useful too. It's really about putting your husband or your partner in the role other than enemy. And so by engaging them as an ally in trying to help you with your rage, it sort of flips the script on it.
I also have 4 sons, you know, and I have a husband who I love and admire as a man, as a person. And so for me, wanting men to be allies and recognizing that the system that they're operating under is in its own way, maybe the flip side, but there is an injustice for men in a world that patronizes them as parents or expects them to be breadwinners and all the pressure that comes with that. And so what motivates me is just being transparent with my husband and honest with my kids about what these pressures and injustices look like and how we're imperfectly trying to do the best we can in this system, because I need better for boys and men as well, not just for girls and women.
Absolutely. Patriarchy hurts men too. It hurts everybody. And I think we don't realize how important the way that we set up the division of labor in the home, how important that is for our children, because they see it. They know who makes dinner. They know who does laundry. They know who does the outside work. So I think it's really important that parents talk about what the division of labor is going to be. And I would also say, to answer the earlier question about what moms should do about their rage in terms of their husbands, I would also, and I know this sounds like self-promotion, but I mean it so much, I would tell them to give their husbands the book to read. Because I think that sometimes it is hard for us to listen to the people who we are the closest to. And so I think that actually giving them the book to be like, please read this and you will understand a little bit more about what my experience is like could be really useful. And there's also a great list in the appendix. I think it's like 19 things partners can do to alleviate their spouse's mom rage. And it's a great list about different things that partners can do in the home to help moms feel less overwhelmed, less pressure, less work.
Thank you. That's a great resource for our listeners. I think one last thing I want to talk about is this idea of a selfish mother and kind of contrasting that label with this intensive mothering, this martyr mothering. I'm a true mother when I'm utterly selfless, when I give everything I have, when I'm endlessly gentle, no matter what, not an unkind word and all of that, versus this idea of selfish. And is there another way to understand selfish? Because in my own journey, I had to learn the hard way, like so many of us, that no one else is going to put me first on the to-do list. And I fundamentally reject that it is selfish to put myself first. But of course, it took me a decade to get there as a mom. What is a new narrative of healthy motherhood?
Yeah, that is such a great question. You know, I think that intensive mothering requires the self-erasure of the mother. In order to be a good mother, you have to disappear. You have to give up all your needs. You're a person who has no needs and everyone else's needs trumps yours. And that is part of what causes mom rage. I think mom rage is actually one of the ways that we are clawing ourselves back to ourselves. We're saying, I'm here. And when I remember in my childhood, one of my strongest memories is when my mom, I think she lost her job. She worked at a university teaching English, and she lost her job and she went up to the attic and she started painting for a year. And I remember thinking, that's so crazy. Like, what is she doing? And I will never forget how impactful that was for me, that she was like, I just want to try painting. And she ended up being an artist for the rest of her life. And it really made a difference to me. And I think, like I said, with how our children are watching with division of labor, our children are watching the ways that we treat ourselves. And I know that I am a much better mother when I am happy. And the things that make me happy, in addition to my family, are making sure I'm writing, making sure I'm seeing friends, going to see music, going to see arts, plays, talks, and making sure I exercise. When I take care of myself and feed the parts of me that are not mother, I am such a happier and better mother. And so I think that the narrative that we're taught about disappearing in order to be a perfect mother is a lie, obviously, because of how we're all miserable. And actually, it's the opposite that's true, that the more that we are quote unquote selfish means the more that we're actually taking care of ourselves.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that example of your own mother embodying her humanity and the full spectrum of it and not just that mothering side of her. I think that's so powerful as an image. Minna Dubin, thank you for joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Well, that's it for our episode. Minna, thank you so much. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to our podcast. We'll be back next week with another great guest. You don't want to miss it. As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. So if you can right now, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving a review takes no more than 30 seconds, but it really helps other people discover our show. And I read all of your feedback. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett, with audio editing from Joel Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Olivia Hendrickson. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50,
luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.